pour l'histoire de l'épidémiologie et de la statistique. Alors, finalement, il a grandement apprécié ses collègues et ses étudiants. Alors, je veux donner l'étage Dr. James Hammond. Merci.
Merci. Merci pour ça. Bienvenue à tous. I will not keep you the full hour if I can help it. So I've written out my talk, because otherwise it would be 3 hours long. And I will give you, without any words, my 30-second abbreviated bio, which some of our students see. My primary school. 1857. I was born in 1947. Secondary school. 2 degrees in math and stat. And then picked Waterloo out of the yellow pages, basically. But very lucky. I'll talk more about this man. And back to McGill. And I have a website here that's going to be important, because I actually have today's talk on there already. And I will put the lyrics that go with the slides after this. The beauty of writing out a talk is that the lyrics are here, and I will put them on, so you don't have to listen through the whole thing. No, because sometimes reading is important, or the audio is important. So I've found out that video isn't important, but audio is. So I'm going to audio tape it and also put the audio on. And then you can send it around. So that's the story. Now, back out of there. Escape, I guess. Whatever. That's on whatever. I don't remember where that was. Acrobat Reader. So now to the talk. So I actually developed this talk in a career day in our department maybe 20 years ago. And then I was invited to be an after-dinner speaker in Ireland at the Conference of Statisticians of Ireland about 10 years ago. And these monkeys gave me 4 minutes to talk after dinner. Why? Because they all wanted to get to the bar. So I'm going to draw on some of that material. Actually, when I came back, I was so annoyed, I said, I'm going to write it up anyway, and I put it on my website, all of the embarrassing things that happened to me in my first 10 years. Well, not all of them, but a lot of them. And I'm going to mention some of those today, but again, that material is on the website, so I've gone on to some new stuff as well. So that's what I already had on the website. When I put it on there, I especially dedicated it to this master communicator and master professional, dean of American statisticians, basically, professor of about 5 different departments at Harvard, God knows how many books, but the ultimate professional. And just in 3 years, I learned more from him than all of their thing up to then. The other one, it was a good colleague of mine, and he'll come into the story again, is Steve Legakos, who I knew for 7 years, starting at Buffalo when I joined Marvin Zellin in Buffalo. And I put on here for Steve his sailboat and us out on Lake Ontario from the U.S. side, somewhere between 75 and 77. Why do I only know that? Because I had a beard, and I knew I only grew a beard starting in 1975, and it's before I went to Washington, or to Boston. So it's an interval-centered observation. Right? I'm going to tell a story about this mentor, who probably the biggest stroke of luck I ever had in a casual conversation one time when I was leaving 10 days before I left Boston to come here. Barbara asked me something about ROC now, so I had no idea, and it turned out into something very big. She's still going strong down there. But I wouldn't be here at all if it weren't for this man who accepted me to come to Buffalo on a fellowship, $3,600 fellowship in 1969. I accepted, and 2 weeks later I got an offer from Waterloo with glossier paper. That's about all I had. No internet, no anything. The brochures were glossier, and William Forbes said to me, come as a landed immigrant. So I came as a landed immigrant. And I'll tell you that story separately later. But it meant that I could get more scholarships and what. The strange thing was, Marvin Zellin was an adjunct professor, remember, at Waterloo. And he would come up from Buffalo to give us logistic regression, and in 72 gave us the Cox model. Marvin comes up to Waterloo and says, Hanley, I remember that name. Didn't we give you a fellowship and you turned it down? And I thought you had gone to Waterloo, Iowa. He didn't know, well, he did know where Waterloo was. We thought he'd gone to Waterloo, Iowa. I said, no, I'm here. Why did you not come to us? And I said, I made up some excuse. But the important thing is, I didn't actually enjoy my time there. I didn't like the supervisor I had. I wasn't proving theorems like the other people. I was doing applied work, collecting data on cigarette smoking in kids, so it was all very applied. It was kind of epidemiology. I did all the theoretical courses, but really felt inadequate. And Zellin said to me, in a very important thing, is Jim, it's not what you do for your PhD that matters, it's what you do afterwards. And it's a very important point. I got the theory, I got respect for data, I didn't prove any theorems, I didn't publish anything from the thesis in a statistical journal, but I had more fun than all the rest of the class there. Right? And I very enjoyed the life out of it. So Marvin really was quite something. He then gave me my first job in Buffalo in 73. We were doing randomized trials. He moved us all, about 10 PhDs, to Boston in 77. And then I met somebody by good luck who told me there was a job at McGill. I had married a Canadian, so I was interested in coming back to Canada, and so on. So, but Marvin is the one, I think, more than any, that has given me the confidence to stand up here today and not be nervous. What he did, I think, is he didn't allow the term a tame statistician. He had a horrible word called don't be a tame, T-A-M-E, docile statistician who says, yes, doctor, no, doctor, here's the p-value, doctor. He would not allow that. We were up front and center as part of the decision-making teams from just like we heard in the clinical trial. That was a huge piece of good luck for me. And so without him, I wouldn't be here today, as I said. So I'm not going to cover all the pieces that I wanted to cover in Ireland 10 years ago, but that I wrote up. I will only cover the communication ones and the big mistakes I made in communication early on in my career. And then I will go on after that. I'll take a few of these, maybe 10, 15 minutes, and then the rest of the time on statistical learning and statistical practice. So to come then to the piece, you can leave that on, it doesn't matter, I guess, this piece on. So I'm going to mention a few of the stories, but they're all online fully. First 2 weeks, I remember, Stuart Pocock was my immediate boss and Zellin, my one, whatever, and he gave me my first sample size to calculate for a clinical trial. And after 2 weeks, I hadn't got it done, and he said, Jim, what's the matter? What's holding you up? I was trying to program the power for a two-sample comparison in Fortran on a mainframe. And that, my first real big lesson in the real world, because we had all theory in Waterloo. First big lesson was, Stuart said, Jim, have you heard of the normal approximation to the difference of two binomials? I said, I have, but I didn't know if I was supposed to use it or not. I hadn't a clue. And any of you coming from a math stat department, you're likely to end up in the same thing as me. But our EPI students know more about how to do approximations than some of us mathematically trained ones do. And so it's a big lesson. And I've never forgotten that, not humiliation, but it's learning. Yeah. The next one was another. It wasn't a calculation problem. It was a communication problem. I had sent my interim report on an ongoing clinical trial. It was a comparison of chemotherapies for advanced colon cancer. I sent it to the oncologist who was heading the study, PI, and after a couple of days, it had to go by mail in those days, that was the only way. A couple of days later, he phoned Zelen, and the other thing is, nowadays you'd have a record of the whole thing because it'll all be an email thing. But Zelen walks into my office and said, the PI says you've done a mistake in the analysis, 2 weeks into my job. And I said, he said, you're wrong. It's got to be wrong. I said, what's the matter? I had written that the estimated median survival was 9 weeks in arm A and 7 weeks in arm B. And he said, look, it's wrong. Look at the protocol. I kept trying to explain it was a Kaplan-Meier estimate and it needed censored data and there were special things and what. And we went on and on and on and on and how the Kaplan-Meier did this and the Kaplan-Meier did that and so on. And then I realized, he said, no, I'm talking about the protocol. And I said, what do you mean the protocol? I said, look at section 1.2. I said, what's that? So we read it, and it was about the entry criteria to be in the study. And it said, in order there to be an adequate trial of therapy, only those patients with an estimated survival of 12 weeks can be in the study. But your estimated survival is only 9 weeks and 7 weeks. I said, I realized what the matter is. And I said, well, that's not my problem if you oncologists can't estimate how long a patient's going to live beforehand. But, right? But he was using estimated in that sense. I was using estimated because I put a hat. I always put a hat on everything we do. Right? And the word estimated out in the real world is different from the word estimate and point estimate and statistics. Mietnin today would actually still say that estimate is a bad word. We could have come up with something better. Because surveyors estimate. Real estate people estimate the price of your house. Right? But not by the statistical methods that we use. So be careful. So my message is that out in the real world, there's technical language and technical terms being used that are very different from domain to domain. And we have to be careful. And I'm going to come back to it later. A lot of our terminology and statistics is poorly thought out. And actually, our words are designed to confuse. Be aware of that. So if you only live among statisticians, you don't get to see it. The word estimated, actually the lack of the word estimated, made big trouble for another colleague of mine, who I think you won't mind my mentioning her, Robin Tamblyn, 20 years ago here. Vous êtes trop jeune pour souvenir le problème. It was the provincial election of 20 years ago, and Lucien Bouchard was on the hustings out in the Gaspé one morning. And the night before, the Montreal Gazette had leaked a story saying that there was a problem because they had cut back on the Medicare system here, and people had to pay for their drugs, and people were dying of because they weren't taking all the drugs because they couldn't afford them under the new drug program. And Lucien Bouchard, very, very smart guy, it's too bad most of you don't remember him, but he asked Robin Tamblyn to show him the list of 4,046 people who suffered health problems or even died because they had stopped taking their drugs properly when they were required to pay for them. What had happened is that Robin had put the number 4046 people in a report, and the journalist had said 4,046 people had had problems because of that. So what did Bouchard do? He said, I'm very worried, show me the list. And then the journalist had figured out that this was from a model. This was not a list of people who died of heat wave or died of the flu. This was a difference by putting beta equals zero or x equals zero and x equals one in a model. It was an estimated model. So if all she had done was put the word estimated, that's where it would have been helpful. Or put approximately, or based on our model, this. But that's got her in big trouble. And actually, Bouchard after that had not another word because he said, oh, you mean it's an extrapolation bias. That's the word he used. Only 2 hours after this leak in Montreal, he shut it down right there and then. But it was a major embarrassment to think that McGill was telling Bouchard and the PQ that they were killing that many people or hurting them. So just be careful of your work. Right? Estimated, when you write full numbers with four-digit accuracy, say how you got them. It's important. Now, to come to communication again, another big, oh my God, I still probably should see a psychiatrist about this. It still bothers me so much. I was 5 years post-PhD, and my first serious paper in statistics was actually on bivariate survival curves. And Steve Legakos invited me to an invited session in JSN 5 years after. And I went with my big load of transparencies, and Steve had to pull me off the stage physically when the end of the time of the talk was, because I'd only gotten halfway through my slides and hadn't rehearsed. I'm serious. We got no training in that in Waterloo. Today you guys are very good, so I won't belabor the point about rehearsing and PowerPoint and all that. But my God, it's still, you know, is embarrassing. But then I have to tell a story that Steve told me about him and Fred Mosteller, those two guys I showed you at the beginning. There was, in the 1970s, I guess, or early 1980s, a major scare about a food dye, it's put into food, red dye number 40. It's a food dye, and there was worries that it was causing cancer in rats, and Steve and Fred had reanalyzed the data on its effect, and they had gone down to Washington to testify in front of the Food and Drug Administration. And they went the day before, got checked into their hotels, rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed, and Steve was fed up because this report had taken 6 months of his life before him. I remember his wife calling him Fast Fred when she meant it's Fred who will want 25 versions of everything. Then they went to dinner and said, Steve, oh God, finally we're finished rehearsing. On the way back from dinner, Fred said to Steve, let's rehearse one more time. And they rehearsed in Fred's hotel room. And Fred was a real stickler for presentation, real professional. He'd had his trousers, his suit, he had it cleaned and pressed, and he didn't want to crease it, you know? He didn't want it to get wrinkled, so he had hung it up in the closet in the hotel room, and he rehearsed his talk to Steve, as I have to read Steve's word. He had, right? Steve had to listen to Fred rehearse his talk, and Steve's words were, Fred was wearing these 1940s style drawers or underwear that extended down past his knees. This guy's 65 years of age, his boss at Harvard, and poor Steve has to rehearse in front of this guy in his underwear. Right? So I said to myself after hearing that, if Fred Mosteller, who was 65 at the time, still has to rehearse his talks, but he was a professional from the early days in the 50s. He presented statistics live on NBC. He taught statistics live in classroom conference, Continental Classroom, 1950s. So Fred was the ultimate professional. But so professional, he wanted to rehearse it in his underwear. Anyway, Steve, when I told Steve about it, Steve's dead now, but when I told him, Steve said, oh yeah, I think I had repressed that. I had forgotten about that. But anyhow, another important lesson I got in communication, and this one is still real, I think. Barbara, it was two Ivy League professors taught me this lesson. Barbara was the radiologist I told you. She and I sent in a paper on maximum attainable discrimination. We had fitted a saturated model, and we were trying to get some measure for it. And so we're trying to show, using data we'd collected from every CT scan of the head that they had done in Boston in 1978. CTs were new in Boston in 1978. We collected 2,000 because the medical people were saying, they're sending everyone and his dog to the CT, even if it's just a headache. We should be able to figure out which signs and symptoms would be almost, in a profile, would almost surely lead to a negative CT. So why do the CT if it's going to be negative? We tried and tried and tried and couldn't show that we could rule out anybody. And so anyway, we sent in the paper to the, but before we did, Barbara was always on to me about giving talks and, just like to send the Steve one, 12 talks, 12 slides, Jim, for 10 minutes. 12 slides, and I had 35. And she didn't like my writing either, because I had fought with my supervisor, and he told me my writing was too long. And I said, well, he had a secretary correct my writing, because he was the dean at Waterloo Forbes, and he had a secretary who would do the editing. And I wouldn't take editing from a secretary, and I said, no, he said, it's up to you. You don't have to, learn if you want, but you'll pay for it later. And so here it is. I send my second paper to the journal, and Barbara let me send it in. She didn't bother editing because she knew I was stubborn. And I still remember the review, signed by Alvin Feinstein from Yale. Alvin was like the big guru at the time. He said, listen to this, first page of your second paper you ever submitted. I stopped reading this 28-page paper on page 6 because it was so unclear I didn't understand it. I think what it proposes has already been done. And you know the common thing then? He gives us 3 references. That's how I figured out it's Feinstein, right? Because he referenced himself. But the paper is so badly written that instead of reinventing the wheel, I think he has reinvented the ellipse. Let that sink in a while for you. After that, I got very serious, and now students of mine in the last 10 years have suffered so much because I still remember that insult about reinventing the ellipse, right? And anyhow, I like writing now, but I'm not great at it. And honestly, writing is a very important thing, still. A few years ago, I sent a first draft to a colleague. This colleague, I think. Where is he? This guy. I sent it to him over at the Vic. And he got me involved in all that screening thing. And the manuscript comment he had for me was, Jim, have you given this anywhere? What do you think he means by that? Have you given it anywhere? He meant, had you given a talk on it? And I said, no. And he said, it shows. It shows. I said, what do you mean, it shows? He says, I found that, and he's 96 now, this guy. And he's still going strong. He said, and when he was learning tricks from the 1940s, the best way to know how much you can say and what to say and how to organize it and select the right material is give a talk on it first. That's how he did it, right? And then he had figured out also how to give the talk. And the way to give the talk was write it out. He used to use the yellow legal pads. And when he came to page 8, he knew that was enough. He had enough words for a 10-minute talk. How many words for a 10-minute talk, by the way? I know it's how many slides, but how many words is it? The BBC tells its news readers, 100 to 120 words a minute is the speed you can go on news reading. 100 to 120, it's a lot of words. 100 to 120 words a minute. In debates, you can get up to 160, 170. So I now write out mine, and I have here, I'm supposed to be at 1386 words by now, so that's supposed to be 13 minutes or something like that. So yeah, it's a good rule. So listen to the 1 minute BBC news one time and count the words. It's a good exercise. Okay? The most embarrassing one I have, what time did we start, by the way? 4:35, okay. The most embarrassing one I've written out in some detail in the book, in the piece, because it's too long, right? And it was a 10-minute consultation I did about a sample size one August when I was ready to go off on vacation, and they had said to me, I said, what's it about? And I'd worked with this person before, so she knew me a lot well. He said, what's it about? And she said, it's about exercise classes and the dropout from exercise classes. And she said, you know what, do you know how bad the dropout rate is from exercise classes? I expect it's not changed in 30 years. It's 50% dropout rate in exercise classes. And she says, I'm a psychologist, that's such a waste. I'm trying to get down the dropout rate. And she says, what sample size and what power? And I said, what would be a big improvement? And she says, if I could get that down to 30%, that would be a major improvement. So I was fishing for the delta, you see, for the sample size. And I said, okay, difference of two proportions, delta is 20%, 20 percentage points. I knew right away that was, you needed about 95 patients per group for that, for 80% power. I'd done so many of them by hand in the last 7 years with Zelen that I pretty well knew, right? And so that was fine. I said, oh, good. And she said, oh, good, we have 200 subjects, not patients, subjects. So read the rest of it. It's a very embarrassing but important story as to what I screwed up with the 10-minute conversation, you know, consultation. So I leave that. I mentioned Fred, the consummate whatever. Fred wrote this piece in 1980 about how to give a talk and how to give a lecture and how to give various things. It really is worth reading. It's all here. Every one of these links works. And a bit more about Fred and the TV in the early 50s as well. But this is a beautiful thing. And good advice there, so I can't better that. Yeah, so now I want to just finish. I said I'd talk one little thing about the media, because it was another learning thing for me. And then I'll go on to my own statistical learning. But this was a silly piece of research we did back in 2003, I think, about the survivors of the Titanic. How long did they live? Did they live as long as the rest of the population and so on? A colleague said to me, Jim, you don't need good data in a paper. What you need is a good title, right? And I said, okay, but this the Christmas edition of the BMJ is very rigorous. They take rigorous articles, but they're often on lighthearted topics. They're not going to change the world. But what was very interesting is, and I was just using it because it was a good example for teaching life tables and biases and so on, and I think I've actually put here one interview that I did afterwards on radio about it, and the guy said to me, why did you do it? And I said, mainly for teaching about censoring and, immortal time bias and some tricky things. But in fact, that was fine. But of course, what we found was that, and I'm curious what you think, who are we going to use as a comparison group? You're going to compare? So, I mean, we had data. We didn't have a question. So we had to make up a question. So I said, well, why don't we just think of it as, did they live longer than they should have, or shorter than they should? Because they had this big trauma of getting off the Titanic. Maybe, who would be the perfect comparison group for them? And I remember a lot of the Titanic people were first-class passengers. So who would you compare their longevity with?
The ones who died.
Well, that's pretty easy. That's pretty easy. Right, talking about the longevity for the next whatever. So we thought maybe the Harvard graduating class, or, you know, some big fancy groups that were other first class types, right? Or the ship from the week before. But this was the first voyage of the, and only voyage of the Titanic, so that couldn't work. You could pick another ship on the line, but the problem is those would be ideal comparisons, but there was no way you were going to get the data from those, right? Because it's only these people have been tracked in great detail. So we had to go with what we had. So we ended up, because we couldn't find any life tables specific by social class or anything like that, we ended up taking the American life table for the average American male and the average American white female as well. And just to be sure, we took Sweden as well, because they, A, because they had life tables, and B, because a lot of people were, for third class, were coming from Sweden and Finland and Ireland to North America and staying. So they were going the other direction very often. Anyhow, that's fine. But my point is going to be about dealing with the media now. This paper got more media attention than all of the rest of my 45 years work together. And in fact, in Montreal, I didn't even want to tell the neighbors that this was in the newspaper. But the Gazette found out about it. I didn't want McGill to know about it. It was sort of a teaching paper. And McGill told the Gazette, and the Gazette started calling. Other people started calling me as well, and so on. And I found out you've got to be very careful with the media. Very careful, and it's a very different thing describing your words to them than the others. And the first thing is they're very nice to you, and they're friendly, and they butter you up, but they're not your friends. They have the tape recorder on, and they're waiting for you to say something silly or controversial. Right? And if any of you have to deal with the media, get training, number one, or take advice from my media-savvy colleague, who has just died this year, Abby Lipman. She was a real pro at dealing with radio. And she said, Jim, here, especially you, Jim, you go off all over the place. Here's what you need to do. Write out your message, especially make it in sound bites if you can. And then no matter what they ask you, pick out a word in that question and say, I'm glad you asked about that, and then give your message. They change again. They give you a different question. You hear the politicians doing it. You see them doing it. That's how we work it. If you want to get your message, write it out and keep at it and don't change. Of course, did I? No. I talked for 10 minutes and he got a stupid quote out of me that's really wrong and embarrassing. And so on. So be careful. But anyway, the one who called me from, I think she was English, she said, she wanted to know where the three people were from. She was going to do a story on the three survivors, the human side of it. And there were three still left alive at that point. They were in their late 90s. And I said, I only deal in aggregates. I don't deal with individual stories, but I direct her to the internet site where we got the data from anyway. But it was the next sentence that she had that was the most telling. And I'd never thought about it until then. She said, it's a pity you didn't find it, because there's no difference there. We had big arguments about the p-values and all silly things. We said, these are pretty crappy data. Don't make too much of them, just for fun. But there's nothing obvious here. But she said, it's a pity you didn't find the difference so we could have had a story. So look what the media are doing. If they're looking for a difference or something to make an interesting story, no difference doesn't sell newspapers, right? But interestingly, the other guy, in the Gazette, the guy I didn't want to talk to, it was a couple of days before Christmas, and luckily my name was not on the first page, it was on the second page. And even my colleagues didn't realize that it was me, because they don't often read into the second page. But he was very different, because he talked about turning Darwin on his head and survival of the fittest. He had the whole story written, by the way, before he even called me. See? But anyway, he was able to make a story out of the fact that it turned Darwin's theory on his head. But the thing I'm actually most proud of is I don't know very many newspapers where you can find a survival curve. Isn't it true? Right? But again, a point about it. Don't use estimated survival on the y-axis. Don't use survival probability. I'll read you the y-axis. Percent still alive on each anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. That's the label here. Percent still alive. But I have seen the most crazy things out of survival packages. You know, it's like our theta hats and our this and our that. And don't do that. And then put in the real dates. I put in years as well, whatever. So, anyhow, but my message was that there's a lot of, back to the woman in England, the press person, there's a lot of filtering goes on. And by the time you get a result out, it's been filtered, and lots of results don't get through at all, and it all depends on what they're filtering on. So when you think about the p-value that gets to the public at the end, it's so cherry-picked that it honestly is meaningless. Right? And university press offices don't help in this, because they want the positive p-values as well. So now I want to switch over. This was all the talk from, you know, before and so on. And en français, say okay as well. They were good about it. They made a decent story out of it, that equal is okay. Yeah. So I now want to come on to these last two topics about statistical learning. And I'm making a bit of a joke here about statistical learning, because I don't mean AI or machine learning or deep learning or any of that. I do mean deep learning, but it's my deep learning. All right? My deep learning. And I tell you, that's the hardest learning to do. But I think, you know, communication is important. But honestly, even before, I used to say there are three words in statistics that matter. Like in real estate, it's location, location, location. What's it in statistics? I used to say it's communication, communication, communication. And I think that's probably still correct, right? But before you can communicate, you've got to understand, right? And so we must continue to deepen our learning and understanding. And you could call it continuing education. I think that was talked about today. You're only going to keep learning. But I think more important than learning, to me, you're going to really understand something for the first time 25 years after you so-called learned it in school. That's when... I find in teaching myself, that's when I really understood what things were and how things work. So I'm going to share with you a few of my strategies. They're probably very particularistic to me as to how I kind of over the 40 or 50 years have deepened the learning. I don't want to get too fancy, but I would rather understand well the basics. And I think it's important. Because that's actually what gives you the confidence later. Where people are going to get you on is the basics. The sophisticated side, you know, fine. But if you don't have the basics right, you're going to get tripped up at something. Just to give you, well, no, I'll leave it go with that. Yeah. So here are a few of the ones, kind of the strategies I have. Yeah, and the first one is be minimal, be minimalist, and so on. What do I mean by that? I mean, if ever you want to try and understand something, take the simplest, smallest possible case you can. If you're trying to show that this is biased or unbiased, I hope that's right, study in the case of n equals 2 and enumerate all the possibilities. And don't take a y that's continuous, take a y that's binary. Right? Take a two-point random variable and give it any weights you want, but you can work out all the possibilities of what s squared could be, and you'll see right away why it's biased. Right? The same thing with this one here. You know, we all remember, I'm sure, in our sleep, variance of beta hat in the GLM, or in the linear model, is sigma squared x prime x to the minus 1, x transpose x to the minus 1. Well, that never spoke to me. That never spoke to me. I don't know if it speaks to you or not. Do you think in algebra? Do you dream in algebra? Do you deal in matrix algebra in p dimensions? No, you don't. So what the hell does it mean? Well, go back to what it means in one dimension. And don't even put beta 0 plus beta 1. Put a model that goes through 0. And then you'll have a scalar variance to worry about. And then you'll understand. And then you'll actually see what's really happening. So we've done that, and I've challenged people here. This is the smallest data set I've usually analyzed in class. Two observations, but I make them go through the origin, the line, so that this is not there's some ambiguity here. There's going to be residuals and so on, right? But you can understand an awful lot from what I call two data points in a model with one parameter. In fact, I would challenge you now, and because you can fit lots of different error models and so on to that, I would challenge you to think about the smallest possible model you could fit in GLM. How many observations and how many parameters? I'm saying one parameter, keep it as small as possible. How many observations should you put in to test that you know what you're doing?
Three.
One. One observation. And then you should get a variance of beta hat from that. Beta now will be the mu, obviously. It'll be the mean, right? The mother of all regressions is y equals 1, right? Tilde 1. So how can I get away with one observation and get a standard error?
Bootstrap.
Huh? What did she say?
Bootstrap.
Bootstrap? You actually can. Let me give you the observation. You have those cookies we had today. You got to see one of those cookies and it had 9 chocolate chips or 9 raisins in it. So how many do you think they put into chocolate chips on average? Mu is, y is mu, right? It's our best estimate. You got one observation, one cookie, right? Can you put that into GLM and get a standard error for it? Come on, guys, don't be afraid to be wrong.
No.
Yes. Provided if you put it in just GLM, if you put LM in, it'll say I have no way to get a standard error because there's only one observation. If you put GLM and say Poisson, it'll give you a standard error of 3. And you said, how did it do that? Well, it borrowed it from the model. The model is Poisson, and the variance in the Poisson is from the model. Right? So you see what I'm getting at? Sometimes the simplest thing can make you understand. Harder, much easier than the other stuff. The same thing when we did a very interesting and best-selling GEE introduction paper, this one here, that last one. And we did that because when SAS came out first with a macro and I didn't understand GE for the life of me, this is what's going to happen to you when you're out in the new business and you're past school. The only way to do it is figuring out some data sets of your own, right? Small data sets where you should know the answer and could do it by hand and then check the macro and so on against that. So we took the simplest correlated data we have is one family with one child and another family with two children. Fit the model, fit the mean model to that. Don't go into any other betas, just the mean model. So that's what I'm talking about. We, of course, we've done lots of props and lots of these visualizations over the years. The only thing I would say here is the two I like best, the elevator is a lot of fun. And where's this one? This one's been a lot of fun. Sampling from this is a lot of fun because you can actually do it by internet. But there's 930 million observations in the data set of how deep it is all around the oceans of the world because there's a very fine grid. And you can also estimate, it's a lovely teaching example because you can ask people to estimate what percentage of the world is covered by water. Right? Because it gives you whether you're going to land in water or not if you put in a random XY longitude and latitude. So it's great fun. So these are the sorts of things that I'm looking for always to try and help me understand and so on. Un autre avec Christian Genet pour le lien entre le poisson qui est discret et le contenu, le gamme, right? And there's an upper tail area of the poisson is the lower tail area of the chi-square of the gamma. That seems very strange that there's the same tail area between a random variable that's continuous and another one that's discrete. So we had a lot of fun doing this. And until I drew and made this thing and made up a story, and Christian supplied a great story for it, about going to Mars and you could only bring so many batteries or something like that, it was really good. Because you could use the time dimension or the count dimension. And so, of course, we've done a lot on simulations as well. And I let you play with these yourself. They're all on here, you can play with them. You have to get Java working for a few of them. But this is probably my favorite, the Bridge of Life. Because it's about visualizing the force of mortality. Because I don't know if you were actually know the force of mortality. It's called M, I think. Still, MX or M, whatever. We have a hazard function in biostat. And we have, very good. And we have, I forget what the other one is, anyhow. But the main thing is, we did a little piece. If there's time left, maybe I'll play that one. But you can play it afterwards yourself. And then, but again, I think this is the beauty of living in the internet age, that my big philosophy is also sharing stuff once I get it. I can't stand learning stuff and not sharing it. Probably a psychologist should be asking me about that too. Why? In any case, I put more here trying to make a point with the last one or two, but actually when I realized that these are all sort of in the same thing about unity and students who heard me say, it's about saving neurons, right? Not having to remember specific formulas for specific things if they're all special cases of a general case, right? So try and think of the world in a big way rather than several small little separate chapters. That's why I put in that the variance of Y bar here has the same form as the variance of P hat or pi hat or whatever you want for the binomial. Why? Because the only difference here is that these are 0, 1 Ys versus these are continuous ones. But the structure is the same. The structure is the same. We did a lot of work here trying to say that you really shouldn't have separate software for every single possible model and every possible kind of data. There's an awful lot of unity in those if you just look at it the right way. And you know, if I'm asked, what is the biggest single statistical paper in my 50 years? Peter, what's yours? In the last 50 years, what's been the biggest thing? Computing itself has been the biggest. To me, the biggest thing probably, and it happened just as I was leaving school, was the GLM paper by Nelder and Wellburn in 1972. That pulled so much stuff together that it saved enormous amounts of computing time. Instead of having people having modules for logistic regression, separate program for this, he just toggled the link and the error and he got them all in one shot and had one thing. And that was important in those days because computer memory and all the rest of it was expensive. and programming was tough. But honestly, that's the way we should be looking at now instead of every software company building a separate specialized module for things. I also think that's where you should start with the mother of all. One is the nine cookies and the nine raisins and the one cookie here. Right? I don't think survival analysis should be its own topic. It's another waste of another semester that you could be here if you could look at the thing in one big way. I was showing the students at the summer school the other day that an awful lot of our data are either interval censored anyway, whether it's interval to the left, interval censored, or right censored, right? But a better word would be we have incomplete data. And censoring is just a form of incomplete data. So why are we making a whole separate course out of survival analysis? I mean, there's a few tricky things about informative censoring and so on and so on. But again, I think we're still in this thing of all separate courses. And in fact, one person in our department said, Jim, how can you be teaching those first-year students in biostat survival halfway through the first term when they haven't had master? I said, look, if they know how to write down a likelihood, the rest is easy. The rest is easy. Writing down the likelihood is the hard part, the thinking. That's all you need. And the last point here on this one, I actually, in a lot of information and variance stuff now, we do an awful lot of stuff with variances, right? It's how kind of our bread and butter in sampling and in efficiency and this, that, and the other. We should really be going back to Fisher and the others and talking about information. When Fisher talked about it, he talked about where should I take the next observation? Where along the x-axis? What concentration should I use? He was trying to optimize the expected information. And so he knew that every observation added on so much in terms of that. Right? And it's much, it tends to give you a lot less trouble than actually trying to work out variance calculations. So I'm getting big in this in my old age. So now, come to the end, the last one, on this topic about learning. And I think curiosity, it's been brought up today in the career thing, is a huge piece of it. And you shouldn't be taking the textbook's word for it. You shouldn't be taking the prof's word for it. You shouldn't be memorizing rules of thumb that you don't understand. Or just because you know how to prove it, you're mathematically, doesn't mean you understand it. Right? We have a rule of thumb that expected count of five or more is needed in a chi-square. Or in or a binomial approximation. Right? That, why is that? Oh, because I was told that. That's not a good enough reason. It's a good enough reason for epidemiologists and geographers and social science people who use statistics. But it's not good enough for us who, the way I always say, all those people, they use statistics the way we all drive cars. Which is what? When the car breaks down, you go to the mechanic. Right? But you don't know the wiring and you don't know what's under the hood. Right? Statisticians should take as their job that they have to know what's under the hood. Right? And when it breaks down and needs fixing, they can't be relying only on rules of thumb, right? Or packages. You have to diagnose the problem yourself, you have to figure out why it could be. You also have to know when you can forego some of the assumptions. When can you get away with something that other people, you know, just because it doesn't fit the thing exactly? Right? I mean, for years and years, this bugged me here about the fact that when you have measurement error in X, which isn't often emphasized in regression courses, that it flattens the slope. The epidemiologists all know it. We didn't know it, right? Wouldn't you say? You guys know it. Right? This stuff. Yeah. But we didn't. And I couldn't explain it to people, mathematically or any other. So it took me a long time, and finally I kind of got it, and we wrote it up and so on. Right? This other one drove me crazy. When I started to teach regression, I had a lot of questions, and I read a lot more after I read Stephen Stigler's book. Why is it called regression? That's a rather fundamental question. Can you explain to somebody why our regression is called regression? Well, no. Most of us can't. Why is the correlation coefficient called R? Why isn't it called C? Why is it called R? Which, in fact, it comes from regression rather than the correlation. So it's silly. When were the first regressions fitted and how? Right? So that led me actually to a lot of my stories and statistics. I found a lot of the answers in Stephen Stigler's book on the history of statistics. And it takes a bit of time, but here's the first, probably the second regression ever done. And it takes a while to get your head around this one. Mind you, this is regression one variable, x and just x, y, and one x. We had least squares long before that, 100 years before that, but they were fitting things with 5 and 6 parameters, so they couldn't plot them. But in one dimension, you can plot y against x alone. You have 3 x's, you can, right? So this is the first regression, and in fact, look what he says. The deviance of the children are of those to their mid-parents is 2 to 3. What's he saying there? He's saying that if your parents are 3 standard deviations taller than their generation, what will you be in your generation? How much taller will you be, on average, how much taller will offspring of these people be than their generation? Right? And he says 2 to 3. If your parents are 3 standard deviations, the average for the children is 2 standard deviations above those. It's a very fundamental thing. And then he called it regression to mediocrity. Regression to the mean, we say today, because mediocrity in those days meant the mean, or the middle. Right? But there's a couple of things that, and he had the data here as well. Actually, when he made these, he had 900 data points. And all he had was 9 numbers here that he fitted the line through. It's not 45 degrees, it's only a slope of 2/3, right? There's his 9 data points, right? And he fitted them by a straight edge. Old-fashioned, right? Where did he get the 9 data points from? He actually had all the parents and all the kids lined up by rows here, and the rows were the parents. So he had 9 rows with a median height for the parents, and then he got the median of all the kids in that row. And that's it. 5? Yeah, done. Yeah. And so then, that's one thing he did, and I'm thinking, okay, but why do you have here and here, why do you have the parents on the y-axis and the children on the x-axis? Isn't that strange for somebody as smart as Galton? And the established convention in those days was y was driven by x, so you put y on this axis and x the driver on that axis. Here we have it upside down. We had to go all the way to London and find out. Because the other thing I'd also ask myself is, what on earth is he doing, multiply all the women's heights by 1.08? Why did he do that?
Save data.
Exactly, save neurons. He didn't want 2 regression lines or 2 correlations. He wanted 1 number. He could have done them separately because the daughters are going to be tall, shorter than the sons. These are grown children, right? And so he didn't want 2. We would today maybe do 2 correlations and average them. He didn't want that fuss. So he says, I'll just make it a unisex data set. So this is a unisex data set. He converted the women to men first, multiplied them up by 1.08. And then he got going. But I wanted to know what would happen if we could reverse that and go from unisex back to the 2 sexes, because this has been around for... So 100 years later, we were able to find the raw data set in the University College London in the archives. And those are the raw data set that Galton put away. They're on my website. They were a lot of fun to find. And you have on the left-hand side the tallest parents. So he had them sorted by the tallest parent, tallest father, and tallest mother, and then sorted mother within father, and then the kids going across. So on the right-hand side, you have the tallest of the samples. The left-hand page, the last page, you have the shortest one. And you can see the regression to the mean happening right there anyway. But of course, that would now mean the 5'6" people, the 5'6" fathers in the last page. And that's what I am, 5'6" or so. Right? Now, so do my kids obey Galton's law? I think so, right? They're all taller than me. And when you don't like a law, statistical or otherwise, I don't advise you to cheat, but I did. All right? So, So, and then the rest of it is here. You can read the rest of it when you're done. Here's my last parting words to you then. That is, be professional, communicate well and keep at it. Don't be dazzled by big data or big money. But the two most important things are, as Mietlin would say to you here, sapere aude. That was the Enlightenment call from the 1700s. It's the motto of the Royal Society. Sapere aude means think for yourself. Or nullius in verba, I think, is another version, right? And put thinking before techniques. Put thinking before techniques. As a consultant, as the rest of it, you have to think through it. I'm thinking through the last example now I'm going to just give you. We had a case last year where I was consulted about confidence intervals that you had to get from putting data together on HIV that gets transmitted from people between partners, where one partner is HIV positive and they don't tell the other partner that they're HIV positive, and there's a big law issue about that, whether you have to tell or not, especially if the viral load, the viral count is undetectable. If you are taking medications that make you effectively HIV negative, should you have to tell your partner? Major issue, two big studies in a certain group, and they say zero cases of HIV out of 500 years of experience. Confidence interval, let's say here zero, confidence interval is here. It's not a lot of data because we have zero cases in 500 person years. We have other data where they're not so sure that these people are, their viral loads are negative. There's some much more HIV there. And the confidence interval from that, even though it's a riskier group, is here. So the confidence interval goes from here to the upper limit here, and for because we have very little data, the confidence interval is actually wider in the group of people we've studied where they are undetectable loads. And then they were trying to make separate statements about these two in the publication. So what do you do about that? There's a serious conflict when you know that the riskier one should have a higher rate of infection. And yet the data are the opposite, because of lack of data. So what, to me there, that's a thinking issue. You know, it's not about getting a software that can fix it. This is about you fixing it, and the fix I suggest to them is, you have experts. You told me that less risky means should be a lower risk, and more should be higher. You know that biologically. You know it biologically, so you should use it, right? The only way I can think to do it is some merge the expert opinion from the biologist with the little statistical opinion. It isn't only statistics. There's these experts who couldn't have told you that for free, right? So that's my point. So anyway, let me read the last sentence, though, just to end up. I just want to thank you for inviting me, for indulging me as I look back on a career that I've thoroughly enjoyed. I think you've all chosen a very good career and have the potential to not only do a lot of good, but to derive a lot of happiness from doing it. Merci à tous.
All right, thank you very much, Jim.
Yeah.
On a 2-3 minutes for médication, we have a couple minutes.
Yeah, questions. But it's a lovely day out there. I felt very guilty keeping you here all this time.
Can you show us the first one?
Huh?
Could you show us that bridge of light?
I'm not
fast
sure.
It.
Fast? Let's see.
How much sunshine is it going to cost us?
Huh? Yeah, that's true. That's true. Where is the bridge of light? Actually, if you go to my regular website, yeah, here. I will. Because you might have trouble getting it going on whatever. Bridge of light. It's right here. Yeah. So these are animations because this guy wrote and said that a bridge of life is like, you're born, you go through a bridge, and as you're going through the bridge, trapdoors open up and you fall down. That's the idea of the force of mortality. And this is Sweden. This may give me trouble here as well now. Let's see. It should be Java. Okay, run it. Yeah, so there's the bridge of life. See the red trapdoors? Right? There's 20 people being born, and they're marching across the bridge of life from 0 to 70 or 80, right? And the red, you can't see from there, but the red means that they're trapdoors and they're falling down. And this is Sweden in 1700. There were not many of them making it to their 50s and 60s and 70s because there was huge mortality here. So these are the infant mortality. This is the survival curve. This is the hazard curve, and this is the log of the hazard. So if I go back and show you a fast version of it. Okay? See what I mean? So you can see Gumpert's law here that says the log of the rate of mortality is linear in age. And then I'll just show you today's Canada one. That's the difference, right? And then I'll show you the last one, which is not Bridge of Life, which is a different model that Carl Pearson did, which is instead of going across on the bridge having holes in it that swallow you up, he said there's people shooting at you as you go across the bridge. And he fitted as a mixture of five shooters stationed at different parts along your line. Right? There's five, and he fit a Peter, do you know this one?
No.
He fit a mixture to the observed distribution of ages of death in England in the 1800s. And if you look at the distribution, it's a great imagination to show that this is five sub-distributions added together. Amazing. And then I said, well, we have to desecrate this, and we have to actually try and make a modern, whatever you call it, Sega Genesis version of it. All right. So I'll give you the slow version first, so you can see what's happening. Right? Those are the five. You see they're marching across? This is, I would never get employed by, who are the gaming companies here? But if anybody good at gaming could help me redo this. So there's the people being picked off by the various ones as they do it. Right? But let me get you the fast version of it. There's the fast version. Right? And you can see how it's converged. Right? So, and Peter, that is the, when this converges, it'll converge to what he started. And under this distribution, Carl Pearson saw five sub-distributions. Five sub-distributions. Imagine. You have all that in the notes, and you have the paper. There's a JRSS paper that goes explaining this as well. So I won't keep you tonight in the thing. But it's remarkable. And the weird thing is he started from the right-hand side. Most of us would say, start on the left, go along in time. He started from the right and found the easiest one to pick was a reverse gamma. Then he took that out, and then he left the rest and fitted the next one that he could see and so on. Just a lot of fun. Let's stop.